they didn't have any bad habits that needed breaking, soaked up his advice like sponges, and didn't challenge his theories about cases. With as many as 20 investigations going at once, there was no way Gaeta could do everything. But by relying on motivated young agents to sit in surveillance, listen to wires, keep track of cooperators, and take care of a million other details, he figured he could operate as what he called a senior case agent, running everything at once. One of those things was the soccer investigation. Gaeta had returned from multiple meetings with Christopher Steele, convinced there was a case to be made involving FIFA, but he wasn't sure what. It seemed a bit amorphous and hazy, but lots of great cases started that way. Gaeta called Evan Norris, a prosecutor he knew in the Eastern District of New York, the federal district covering Brooklyn, Queens, and Long Island. He'd worked with Norris before and believed he was the right man for what seemed a juicy case. Norris didn't hesitate. The FIFA case was now officially open. The only thing missing was someone to run the investigation on a daily basis, and looking over his roster of agents, Jared Randall jumped to mind. He'd had only one or two cases before, and they hadn't gone anywhere. But with Gaeta's more experienced agents tied up on other matters, there just weren't too many other bodies available. Besides, Randall had been a scholarship soccer player at Manhattan College, and actively played on the NYPD soccer team. That alone, Gaeta figured, made Randall the most qualified guy on the squad. Now, sitting in his cramped interior office, Gaeta took the newspaper out of Randall's hand and scanned the news story. "Russia got the World Cup," Randall said. "Yeah," Gaeta shrugged, unsurprised. The veteran agent paused to look out of his office door across the dozens of dingy cubicles that constituted the field office's various organized crime squads. Trophies of successful takedowns were scattered here and there, mixed in with reams of paper, boxes of evidence, bulletproof vests, riot gear, and FBI windbreakers hanging over backs of chairs. Clean-cut agents nursing cups of coffee chatted quietly, bullshitting before getting down to the day's work. The disheveled tableau seemed appropriate for busting two-bit thugs controlling petty crime in the city's outer boroughs, yet far removed from the opulent, pristine meeting rooms in FIFA's airy high above Zurich. Still, Gaeta was an ambitious agent and loved the idea of bringing down the seemingly untouchable mandarins who controlled all of soccer as they ate canapes and quaffed fine champagne. "Imagine," he said to Randall, "if we could get all the way up to that level." Chapter 6. Jack versus Chuck. "Jack," Chuck Blazer began to type on his computer, "I hope this is an April Fool's joke." Over the more than 25 years he'd known the man, Chuck Blazer had seen Jack Warner pull more than his share of outrageous stunts, such as the time in 2003 when he sabotaged a gala dinner for 1,200, celebrating the opening of a new soccer stadium in Carson, California, by launching into a racially charged tirade because he wasn't picked up from the airport in a limo. Or when Warner insisted Trinidad host the U-17 World Championships, awarded himself, friends, and family nearly every concession and contract, and then almost failed to pull it off. Or the moment in 2010 after the Russian World Cup bid team made a presentation to CONCACAF's leadership, and Warner turned to them and archly said, to the shock of everyone in the room, "What's in it for us?" Now, sitting in his apartment high in Trump Tower early on April 1st, 2011, it seemed to Blazer that his irascible old friend was on the verge of another bizarre performance. Warner had been, as was his habit, up before dawn, and his email had popped into Blazer's inbox before 6 a.m., long before he woke up. Fellow Exco member Mohammed bin Hammam had emailed Warner a few minutes earlier, expressing his desire to address the Confederation's membership directly at a special Congress sometime around April 18th, less than 2 weeks before CONCACAF's already scheduled annual Congress in Miami at the beginning of May. The billionaire, after more than a dozen years of loyal service to Blatter, had recently announced his intentions to run against him for the FIFA presidency. Beyond his wealth, he was the president of the Asian Football Confederation, and had played a key role in Qatar's winning bid to host the tournament in 2022, making him a national hero and emboldening him, perhaps, to challenge the most powerful man in soccer. After so many years at Blatter's side, he was familiar with the many tactics the Swiss employed to maintain his position. Bin Hammam wanted the opportunity to solicit all 35 CONCACAF votes alone and in person ahead of the presidential election in Zurich on June 1st. Warner immediately responded by saying he would do my utmost to assist you by hosting such a meeting in Trinidad, then forwarded the message to his general secretary, instructing him to make this happen. Blazer could scarcely contain his fury upon reading the email. He drafted a strongly worded reply, but before sending it first, ran the email by a trusted colleague. Finally, at 9:43 a.m. New York time, he responded. I regret the need to address this issue after the fact, and that you didn't see fit to talk with me prior to your response to Mohammed. He wrote, Mohammed's request, while convenient for him, is really quite impossible for us. For starters, CONCACAF staff in New York and Miami were racing to prepare the Gold Cup competition starting in June, even as they were organizing the Congress in Miami. A Youth World Cup qualifying tournament was being played in Guatemala at that very moment, tying up additional Confederation resources, and the marketing team had an event planned for Mexico City on the same days Bin Hammam had proposed. But even more troubling than the migraine-inducing logistics of fulfilling such a request at such a late hour were Warner's motives for asking in the first place. The office of the president of FIFA enjoyed a status closer to that of a monarch or autocrat than a democratically elected figurehead, and the exalted man's every whim was taken as a command to put into action. Leaders of nations, public intellectuals, and celebrities wanted to be around the president, took his ideas seriously, and showered him with praise. The Swiss authorities, meanwhile, tended to take a hands-off approach to regulating the organization he controlled, charging it a fraction of the taxes paid by for-profit ventures, and giving it freedom to do as it pleased. Forfeiting all that would be devastating. After overcoming the ISL crisis to win in 2002, Blatter had run unopposed in 2007, and made it clear he had every intention to hold on to the vaunted position for many years to come. Blazer and Warner had built their careers at FIFA around allegiance to Blatter, vehemently and tirelessly defending him amid numerous public crises, and routinely delivering all 35 of their confederation's votes as tribute. In exchange, Blatter had offered magnanimity, lavishing FIFA funds earmarked for soccer development on pet projects of theirs, such as a $3 million television studio in CONCACAF's Trump Tower offices that Blazer had coveted, or the vast majority of the $26 million spent to pay for a sprawling sports, entertainment, and hotel complex Warner built in Trinidad. Blazer's daughter, a lawyer, had for several years been given a seat on FIFA's legal committee, while Warner's younger son, Daryl, currently worked as a FIFA development officer in the Caribbean, helping dole out more of the organization's largesse. When Cameroon soccer official Issa Hayatou had run against Blatter for FIFA president in 2002, he too had asked to address CONCACAF's membership. But Warner, in a bold and cunning display of loyalty, made the unprecedented ruling that only a sitting FIFA president could address the formal CONCACAF Congress, effectively shutting out Blatter's rival. Allowing Bin Hammam to speak in Miami would not only fly in the face of that decision, but also risk alienating Warner and Blazer from their Swiss benefactor, who was known for eliminating those who did not support him. Then again, thought Blazer, this wasn't entirely out of character for Warner. In the cutthroat world of FIFA politics, he had never been an easy man to get along with. After more than a quarter century on the Exco, Warner was prideful, vindictive, and easily provoked, coiled like a cobra ready to strike. Though he worked constantly, his administrative skills left much to be desired, and Blazer and his staff pulled most of the weight when it came to the actual work of running the Confederation. Worse still was Warner's insatiable greed. Even Blazer, who was certainly adept at using his office for personal gain, was startled at how nakedly his friend pursued money, and how many times he'd escaped seeming disaster unscathed. Jack Warner thinks he can go through anything, Blazer once wrote. The cagey old Warner had survived so long because of his innate feel for politics. He instinctively understood the rough business of securing votes, shoring up alliances, and punishing dissent. For decades, the key to his power had been the way he lorded over the Caribbean, his little fiefdom. And now Blazer feared his sly old comrade was losing his edge. Bin Hammam was well-liked in the FIFA crowd, sure, and deeply generous in his own right. With Qatar's fortunes on the rise, he was a good friend to have. But aiding Bin Hammam's campaign was tantamount to a betrayal. Atop the FIFA pyramid, one was either with Blatter or against him. "Please," Blazer begged of Warner in his email, "do not destroy the work that needs to be done by rushing into decisions which cause problems for us." If it hadn't been for Blazer, Warner would have never been in such a lofty position in the first place.
The two had met at a CONCACAF Congress in Tobago barely a month after the New Yorker was elected vice president of the U.S. Soccer Federation, and they had immediately hit it off, despite never working directly together.
Then, on November 20th, 1989, the bell rang at Warner's house in Arauca, a suburb east of Port of Spain, just as he was taking his morning tea. At the door was a rather hopeful-looking Chuck Blazer. His unscheduled visit was particularly surprising considering the result of the previous day's contest between the U.S. and Trinidad and Tobago at the National Stadium 25 miles away. During the 31st minute of the tightly contested match, American midfielder Paul Caligiuri had broken free, finding enough space to drill a long, arcing, left-footed shot into the back of the net, breaking a scoreless tie. It was the day's only goal and became known in soccer circles as the shot heard round the world because it sent the United States national team to the World Cup for the first time in 40 years. In the same stroke, Trinidad's side, which had never qualified, was eliminated from contention. Now, sitting with Warner and his wife at their kitchen table, Blazer took a breath and made his big pitch. "Warner," he said excitedly, "should resign from Trinidad and Tobago Soccer Association and run for the CONCACAF presidency." The Confederation's sitting president, Mexican Joaquin Soria Terrazas, was gravely ill with diabetes and couldn't possibly live out another 4-year term, Blazer said. Under Confederation statutes, the most senior CONCACAF vice president would take over should the president die or be removed from office. That meant Gene Edwards, former president of the U.S. Soccer Federation, would get the job. And since the U.S. was scheduled to host the 1994 World Cup, Edwards would be a lock to keep the job when elections were held again on the eve of the world's biggest sporting event. "If Warner didn't move now," Blazer explained, "the presidency would be out of reach for years, if not forever." Blazer offered to work for free as campaign manager, but victory would depend on Warner's ability to whip his colleagues in the Caribbean into line. Once they won, Blazer added, he would be more than glad to handle the daily operations of the Confederation as General Secretary, leaving Warner free to maintain unity among the membership. Blazer had been out of work since the previous May, when he'd been fired as president of the Miami Sharks. He had a pile of unpaid bills waiting for him in Scarsdale, including multiple mortgages and car notes, not to mention a pending lawsuit from a neighbor he'd stiffed on a personal loan, and had discovered there were extremely few paying jobs of any sort in American soccer. This admittedly wild idea felt like the last, best hope. "If you are to be the president of CONCACAF," Blazer implored, "you would have to make yourself available for the next few elections in a few months' time, or wait until 1998, which is far too long." Warner, born in January 1943 to a poor family in Trinidad's southeast, was the third child of an alcoholic and frequently absent father and a stern, devoutly Catholic mother who scraped together a living cleaning houses. His childhood home had no running water, like many in the rural area where virtually every family, including his own, was black. An above-average student and passionate but poor soccer player, he'd gone on to get a teaching degree while also channeling his love of the sport into climbing the administrative ladder of Trinidad's chaotic amateur leagues. For most of his life, his only salaried job was as a secondary school teacher in Port of Spain. And as he slowly lifted himself into the ranks of the nation's middle classes, he managed to gain and hold power in soccer as well. Warner was elected secretary of Trinidad and Tobago Soccer Association in 1974. but his big break came on December 8, 1982, when soldiers came to the house of André Campervien in Paramaribo, the capital of Suriname, shot his dogs, smashed his phones, and dragged the 58-year-old away. Campervien, a former professional soccer player and successful businessman, had publicly criticized the tiny South American nation's government, a repressive dictatorship. That night he was savagely beaten and then shot to death, along with 14 other dissidents. Campervien had also been president of the Caribbean Football Union, an organization he had helped found 5 years earlier, which automatically entitled him to a seat on FIFA's Exco. In the wake of his death, Werner, who had been the CFU's second-ranking official, took both vacant positions, instantly becoming one of the most powerful men in soccer. The Caribbean was by no means a hotbed for soccer talent. Only one team from the region had ever qualified for the World Cup, and interest in the sport in most of the countries was so tepid as to be virtually non-existent. Many national associations were penniless, and their officials rarely traveled abroad, serving as little more than organizers of occasional amateur competitions. Some association presidents seemed completely oblivious to what CONCACAF or FIFA even did. But FIFA and its six regional confederations operated as a simple democracy, allocating one vote to each country, regardless of size or soccer prowess. Thus, tiny Curaçao had the same voting power in CONCACAF as the United States. British territory Bermuda, with a national team that has never ranked higher than 58th worldwide, had exactly the same vote as Brazil, hundreds of times larger, and winner of multiple World Cups. The CFU had been formed in 1978 as a way to give Caribbean nations a seat at the table in confederation long dominated by Mexican and Central American interests. But what Blazer recognized in the Union was an unbeatable voting bloc that could dictate the direction of CONCACAF as a whole, and, by extension, be a formidable force in FIFA as well. By the time he arrived at Werner's door in 1989, the CFU had 18 members, compared to just 9 for all of North and Central America. If Werner could bring the entire Caribbean into line, Blazer explained, then there would be no obstacle to attaining and holding power for decades to come. On April 6, 1990, Werner was elected president of CONCACAF, just as Blazer had predicted. He promptly made his American friend the Confederation's general secretary. In the more than 40 years since Werner had first become a soccer official, helping run Trinidad Central Football Association when he was still a schoolboy, he had been subject to a string of accusations of financial mismanagement, self-dealing, bribery, vote-selling, and especially ticket scalping. When Trinidad hosted the U.S. for that momentous November 19, 1989 World Cup qualifier, for example, Trinidad Soccer Association had somehow managed to print 20,000 more tickets for the match than there were seats in Port of Spain's National Stadium. The facility was designed to hold only 25,000 people, but almost 40,000 crammed in nonetheless, leaving thousands of bewildered ticket holders stuck outside. Furious, the fans swarmed the team buses for both countries, and the subsequent outcry prompted a federal inquiry. Werner, the Soccer Association's secretary since 1974, initially said only 28,500 tickets had been sold. He claimed that the remaining stubs, which had been painstakingly counted by investigators, were counterfeit and refused to issue refunds to people denied entry. But several months later, Werner admitted that the total number of tickets had in fact been 43,000. He denied profiting and was never held to account, but the ticket sale money was never accounted for and no refunds were issued. In 2006, Trinidad finally qualified for its first World Cup, triggering a large allocation of tickets by FIFA to Trinidad. Under FIFA rules, its officials could not resell tickets for more than face value. But late that year, two secret investigations by auditors Ernst & Young were leaked, showing that Werner had made more than $900,000 from scalping the World Cup passes. The scheme involved a company that was owned by Werner and had exclusive rights to sell Trinidad's block of tickets, which it did, along with travel packages, to brokers in a variety of countries, at huge markups. After rumors of the scheme reached Zurich, Werner told FIFA he had severed connections with the company, when in fact he had simply transferred control to his elder son, Daryon. Faced with significant evidence of misdeeds by one of its most powerful officials, FIFA expressed disapproval of Werner's conduct, but said it would not discipline him and close the case. "It cannot be proven that Jack Werner knew about the resale of tickets at higher prices," said the head of FIFA's disciplinary committee at the time. FIFA couldn't punish Daryon Werner either because he had no official position in soccer, and thus was out of its jurisdiction. It did ask the company to repay $1 million, which would be sent to charity, but only $250,000 of that was ever sent to Zurich. It was hardly just tickets. All the way back to his days at the Trinidad and Tobago Football Association, Werner had figured out that the nation's Ministry of Sport would cover two-thirds of the cost of staging international competitions, or hosting sports congresses, and such things were notoriously hard to audit. At the first-ever Caribbean Football Union meeting back in 1978, Werner proposed a pan-Caribbean tournament and offered to host. Prior to then, Trinidad had rarely held any sort of international soccer event. But by 2009, Trinidad had hosted the regional championship 9 times, and had also been the site of 3 Caribbean Youth Cups, 3 CONCACAF Under-17 Youth Championships, and 5 CONCACAF Under-20 Championships. No other country in CONCACAF, including huge and wealthy countries like the United States or Mexico, came anywhere near that record of hospitality. Each was an opportunity to rake in cash. Werner's CFU staff learned to routinely double or even triple the actual costs of events when submitting budgets, and Werner's travel agency handled all the travel arrangements. Werner was always working an angle. Blazer knew he kept secret bank accounts in Trinidad and elsewhere in the Caribbean, some of them in the name of the CFU, but separate from the actual CFU accounts and administered only by him. Everything revolved around Werner's unquenchable thirst for money. He had even been accused of pocketing hundreds of thousands of dollars meant to rebuild Haiti after its devastating earthquake. And he still owed Blazer a quarter of the long-overdue South Africa World Cup bribe money. For years, Werner and Blazer had been inseparable. In their early days at CONCACAF, Werner would sleep in the guest room at Blazer's house in Scarsdale when in town. When he moved to a big apartment high in Trump Tower, Werner would stay with him there too. Blazer often called Werner his best friend. But over time, their relationship soured. When Werner came to New York, he'd stay in a hotel, and Blazer didn't even bother inviting him out to dinner. Instead, he would head to Elaine's for a lively evening on the Upper East Side, where Werner would opt for a quiet meal at Sevilla, a Spanish restaurant he loved in the West Village. Their relationship had become almost purely transactional, with each man focused on his own side projects. That chilly distance increased when Werner was elected to Trinidad's parliament in 2007. Money, unsurprisingly, was at the root of most of their escalating conflicts. The April 1st email seemed of a piece with Werner's increasingly erratic behavior. From where Blazer sat, the whole Bin Hammam affair reeked of lucre. The Qatari could have arranged to meet the CONCACAF membership anywhere. And indeed, they were already all going to be in Miami during the first 2 days of May. But Werner kept insisting on a special conference in Trinidad, which was a logistical nightmare to get to. It wasn't hard for Blazer to guess why. Werner had surely figured out some way to make a bundle of cash by handling the travel arrangements, which he insisted be paid for by Bin Hammam. Blazer rarely appeared in CONCACAF's 17th floor offices before the stock market closed at 4. Instead spending his days in his upstairs apartment in shorts and a t-shirt. Most Fridays, he didn't bother coming down at all. On this particular Friday, he beat his employees to work, though most had no idea he was even there until they heard him yelling on his phone from behind his closed office door. Since receiving Werner's email that morning, he'd spent hours desperately trying to talk some sense into the man. His clumsy plot to abet a rival to Sepp Blatter, the king of all soccer, seemed beyond reckless. It seemed like mutiny and career suicide. But Werner was a stubborn man, and the more his general secretary pushed, the more he dug in. Blazer proposed that Bin Hammam come to Miami and make a presentation to the membership either before or after the formal Congress. But Werner demurred. He now claimed Bin Hammam had been denied a U.S. visa and couldn't enter the country. That seemed patently ridiculous. Bin Hammam was a wealthy construction magnate with his own private jet and a clean record. America might make it hard for impoverished Mexicans to cross the border, but who ever heard of a billionaire being denied entry into the United States? 2 days later, Warner wrote Blazer again. It will not be feasible to have Bin Hammam make his presentation at the Congress for all kinds of reasons, some articulated and some not, he wrote. If it is that your staff will not be able to assist due to the various events and meetings, then I will have no problem with using the CFU secretariat and local support staff to facilitate or even finding another date in May. Blazer responded an hour later. The delegates for North and Central America wanted to support Blatter, he explained, and calling a special Congress just for Bin Hammam's sake at such short notice was a bad idea. There is also an ethical issue of his paying for a meeting and bringing in delegates, Blazer added. At 3:16 Monday morning, Warner wrote back, Chuck, Bin Hammam does not wish to speak to our members at our May 3rd Congress, and, in some ways, neither do I wish for him to do so, his email read. I will let him talk to the members of the Caribbean Football Union instead, and invite such other members who are willing to attend to do so. This is really my final advice on this matter. Warner, hard to control when he was merely a soccer administrator, had become nearly impossible now that he was a lofty government minister, sending these imperious diktats as if everyone was his servant. If Warner was going to try to burn all they'd achieved to the ground just to make a buck off Mohammed bin Hammam, Blazer would be damned if he'd throw any kindling on the fire. Chapter 7. Port of Spain. Angini Kanhai settled into a chair in the ballroom of the Hyatt Regency in Port of Spain on the morning of May 10, 2011, and took a long, slow breath. After several exhausting weeks, the frenzied work of organizing the CFU conference was finally finished. A neatly dressed, slim 29-year-old Trinidadian, with long, meticulously straightened hair and fashionable glasses, Kanhai surveyed the room. As General Secretary of the Caribbean Football Union, it was her business to know almost everyone in attendance, and she recognized the faces of soccer dignitaries who had been flown to Trinidad, all expenses paid, from Aruba, Puerto Rico, St. Thomas, and nearly two dozen other tropical islands. The seating charts were finalized. The simultaneous French and Spanish translators were in the room and ready. The hotel's kitchen staff was busily preparing lunch. Everything appeared in place. On the low stage at the front of the room, the day's guest of honor, Mohammed bin Hammam, was attempting to give a speech that few seemed to be listening to. Slight and reserved, with light curly black hair and a neatly trimmed beard, he spoke in heavily accented English, promising more say, more support, and more pay if elected FIFA president. As he droned on, Kanhai's boss, Jack Warner, sitting two seats away, passed her a note. "Remind me about the gifts," it read. Kanhai furrowed her brow, quickly scribbling a reply. "Gifts?" Despite being responsible for signing off on every detail of the event, Kanhai had heard nothing about gifts. She tried to push down a sudden wave of anxiety, worried she had somehow forgotten some critical element and would face Warner's wrath. Kanhai had started working for Warner 3.5 years earlier, after answering a help-wanted ad for an administrative position at the CFU. She had imagined herself faxing, filing, and photocopying, but instead found herself jetting around organizing soccer tournaments and putting together meetings like this one, just a week after the CONCACAF Congress in Miami. As Bin Hammam spoke, she and Warner passed a flurry of notes, establishing that she should pick up what her boss called token gifts after lunch, and that they should be distributed that afternoon in the impromptu office set up in the hotel's executive boardroom. After the speeches ended, Kanhai chatted with some of the delegates for a few minutes and then departed. She made the short drive to the Ministry of Works and Transport, just a few blocks away, parking in the building's underground garage. Upstairs, she met Warner's personal assistant, who led her into the minister's office and handed her a locked suitcase from behind the desk, noting that the key was in the outside pocket. with the temperature creeping past 90 degrees on a typically hot and sticky May afternoon. Kanhai rushed back to the Hyatt, eager to finish up so she would have time to go home, shower, and change before returning to the hotel for dinner. A few minutes before 3, Kanhai hustled through the Hyatt's sliding front doors, heels clicking on the polished floor as she swept past the illuminated fountain bubbling in the main lobby and up the escalator. Kanhai took the suitcase to the makeshift office, where two of her CFU co-workers,
Debbie Mingel and Jason Sylvester, were waiting.
Together, the three fished out the key and unlocked the suitcase, which was filled with 2 dozen manila envelopes, one for each delegation. They pulled out one envelope. It was unmarked, sealed, and tightly packed with what appeared to Kanhai like a rectangular box. Satisfied, she went home. On the drive, Kanhai scarcely gave the envelopes a second thought. She figured they were stuffed with more of the same kind of tacky souvenirs handed out at any one of the innumerable conferences international soccer officials seemed to love, perhaps a pen, commemorative coin, or a lapel pin. If anything, Kanhai was more intrigued by the bag itself, which, with its flamboyant orange piping, wasn't the kind of luggage Warner ordinarily used. The matter soon slipped out of her mind, and Kanhai thought little more of it until the next morning, at the Hyatt's breakfast buffet,
when Mingel raced up to her, eyes wide.
"Enjani," she gasped. "It was cash." Chuck Blazer's cell phone rang soon after 4:30 that same afternoon. He'd remained in Miami after the CONCACAF Congress concluded, enjoying his South Beach apartment, which he'd only had use of for about a year, and spending a little time with a few friends in town. The unexpected call came from Anton Seeley, president of the Bahamas Football Association, who was in Zurich for a FIFA event and had been unable to attend the CFU gathering. Seeley wanted to know, did the CFU have enough money to be handing out cash gifts of $40,000 to each soccer federation? What? Seeley explained that his vice president, Fred Lunn, was in Port of Spain for the CFU meeting, and he reached out just over an hour earlier with news that two of Jack Warner's employees had given him an envelope marked Bahamas, containing 400 crisp new $100 bills, divided into 4 neat stacks. The staffers told Lunn it was a gift from the CFU, and that he was free to count the money right then and there. Lunn, incredulous, asked how he was supposed to get that much cash through U.S. Customs on his connecting flight back home.
"You could mail it," Mingel had suggested.
"Are you kidding?" replied Lunn in shock.
"It was no joke," Mingel had said.
The money was a gift, and Lunn shouldn't tell anyone about it, or let anybody see the money. Lunn hurried back to his hotel room and texted Seeley, "Please call urgent." Something smelled very wrong,
and Seeley and Lunn agreed that the money couldn't be kept.
Before returning it, Lunn took a photo of the cash, neatly laid out beside the manila envelope, and when he returned to the boardroom, he noticed a number of other Caribbean soccer officials nearby, some with manila envelopes in their hands and smiles on their faces. "A lot of the boys taking the cash," Lunn texted Seeley. "I'm truly surprised it's happening at this conference." Blazer had seen the CFU's financial statements and knew that it didn't have enough money on hand to pay for a hastily planned meeting, let alone what must have been somewhere around $1 million in cash handouts. CONCACAF was constantly covering the cost of things that the CFU could not, down to paying referees at Caribbean tournaments. So where was all this money coming from? The dots weren't hard to connect. With the FIFA presidential election only 3 weeks away, Bin Hammam was scratching for every vote he could muster. The whole purpose of the Trinidad meeting was to put the Qatari before the CFU voters, and now, just hours after he met them, stacks of cash were being tossed around. There was no polite word for it. These were bribes. Floored, Blazer thanked Seeley for letting him know, hung up, and fired off an email to Warner, demanding an explanation. Soon after Blatter was first elected in 1998, he created several new programs that helped him win loyalty from soccer federations through financial patronage in the name of soccer development. One, the Financial Assistance Program, was created in 1999 to motivate and empower the associations and confederations and strengthen football and its administration in the long term. In practice, that meant $250,000 wired from Zurich to every single FIFA member federation each and every year. For big federations, that was a trivial amount of money. But for small ones, often operated with almost no oversight in countries with little public interest in the sport, it was by far the largest source of revenue. How much of that money actually went to soccer programs, rather than to lining the pockets of the men lucky enough to be elected to office, was anyone's guess. Another bladder innovation, the Goal Program, allowed federations to apply for grants to pay for specific projects, such as soccer pitches or training facilities. Tiny Montserrat, a volcanic atoll in the Caribbean, with only 5,200 inhabitants, is the smallest federation in all of FIFA, and its national team has never been ranked higher than 165th in the world. Nevertheless, it has received some $1.51 million over the life of the Goal Program, largely to fund construction of a set of bleachers and a bathroom overlooking a soccer pitch. Mexico, with a population of 125 million, has received a total of $1.3 million. Over the years, Goal Program money has gone to nearly every country in the world, and nearly every time a pitch is laid or a headquarters is completed, there is invariably a plaque installed nearby noting that it was Sepp Blatter who paid for it. A not-so-subtle reminder to the Federation presidents of Asia, Africa, Oceania, and the Caribbean of who buttered their bread. The huge financial success of the 2010 World Cup left FIFA with an enormous cash reserve, and Blatter wasn't afraid to deploy some of that to his advantage. Addressing CONCACAF's Congress in Miami during the first days of May, Blatter pledged an additional $1 million to distribute to members, calling it a birthday present, in honor of the Confederation's 50th anniversary. At a buffet breakfast at the Hyatt on the morning of May 11th, the CFU delegates in Port of Spain gathered for what was supposed to be a brainstorming session about the future of soccer in the Caribbean. Instead, the delegates heard a venomous tirade from Warner, who was furious that Blazer had found out about the gifts. When Bin Hammam asked to come to the Caribbean, he wanted to bring some silver plaques and wooden trophies and buntings and so on. Warner began in his thick patois. I told him he need not bring anything. He said yes, he wants to bring something for the countries that will be equivalent to the value of the gift that he would have brought. I said to him, if you bring cash, I don't want you to give cash to anybody. But what you do, you can give it to the CFU, and the CFU will give it to its members. Warner continued, because I don't want to even remotely appear that anyone has any obligation to vote for you because of what gifts you have given them. The delegates in shirts and sport coats sat in stunned silence as the speech went on. Warner said he'd be happy to take back the money from anyone who didn't want it. That Blatter himself had been aware of the gifts, that he felt Bin Hammam could protect the Caribbean's interests in Zurich, and that it was critical the CFU maintain its control of CONCACAF by voting as a unified bloc. I know there are people here who believe they are more pious than thou, Warner fulminated. If you are pious, go to a church, friends. But the fact is that our business is our business. We come in the room here, we cuss and disagree, and rave and rant, but when we leave here, our business is our business. And that is what solidarity is all about. It wasn't until 2 that afternoon that Warner finally called his increasingly agitated general secretary. Warner's explanation only made Blazer more incredulous. The cash, he said, had come from Bin Hammam, who originally wanted to give it out personally to all the delegates. Instead, Warner had told the Qatari it should be distributed as a gift from the CFU. That way, Warner figured, he would get the credit. And it wouldn't appear that Bin Hammam was directly buying votes. Blazer was beside himself. In 21 years, we have never bought a vote, he said. We have had elections and been in office all that time and never bought a vote. Now you have allowed this to happen here it completely changes the entire dynamic of the Confederation. This reckless behavior was putting them both at risk. But Warner was defiant. If anyone had a problem, he said, they should contact him directly. After hanging up, Blazer's mind raced. Sure, he'd seen far bigger payments in his years in soccer, but they were always behind closed doors, veiled in secrecy, and neatly covered up with anonymous shell companies, using bank accounts in remote countries. This was a different story. Too many people knew. It couldn't possibly be contained, and if word got back to Blatter before Blazer had a chance to tell him personally, the repercussions could be dire. Desperate, he called his lawyer in Chicago, a former prosecutor named John Collins, for guidance. "I just can't live with this," Blazer said, adding that he was considering telling FIFA. Collins had carved out a niche as a soccer lawyer. He'd first worked for the Chicago-based U.S. Soccer Federation starting in the late 1990s, had advised a women's pro soccer league and the American Youth Soccer Organization, and starting in 2002 was outside counsel for CONCACAF. He took care of 1,000-odd jobs for the Confederation, and had been awarded a seat on FIFA's legal committee. Collins paid close attention to the complicated politics of the sport, and had a gimlet-eyed, unsentimental view on the potential ramifications of sitting on something as explosive as this. Collins saw little alternative, and told Blazer as much. "Sometimes," Collins said, "you gotta do what you gotta do." 2 days later, Blazer called Jerome Valk, FIFA's general secretary, with the news about Warner and Bin Hammam. Valk thanked Blazer and asked him to prepare a formal report on the matter. After hanging up, Valk summoned FIFA's top attorney, Marco Villager, as well as its new head of security, a rangy Australian named Chris Eaton, to his office deep inside FIFA headquarters. The two men arrived to find Valk in an unusually cheerful mood. Restraining a smile, the tall Frenchman told the two men what Blazer had said about the bribes in Port of Spain, and how the wealthy Qatari seemed to have been the source of the cash. "Finally," Valk told them, "we can be rid of Bin Hammam." On May 24th, Collins submitted his findings, citing clear evidence of violations of the FIFA Code of Ethics, to Valk. Working the phone in his Chicago office, he had managed to interview Lunn, Seeley, several officials from the Bermuda and Turks and Caicos soccer associations, and Jeffrey Webb, president of the Cayman Islands Football Association. After hearing 3 independent accounts, Collins felt satisfied that bribes had been handed out. FIFA made the matter public the day after receiving his report, mentioning bribery allegations that were linked to the upcoming FIFA presidential election, and announcing ethics committee hearings on the matter the following Sunday, May 29th, just 2 days before the presidential election. By that weekend, the vast community of global soccer dignitaries had descended on Zurich in anticipation of the Congress, and the city's hotels, restaurants, and bars overflowed with gossip and speculation about what had happened in Port of Spain. Then, on the eve of the hearing, Bin Hammam abruptly withdrew from the presidential race. "I cannot allow the game that I loved to be dragged more and more in the mud because of competition between 2 individuals," he said in a statement. "The game itself and the people who love it around the world must come first." Early on May 29th, FIFA's ethics committee met to hear about the events in Trinidad from Warner, Bin Hammam, Debbie Mingel, and Jason Sylvester. It would also hear from Blatter himself because Warner had filed his own ethics complaint against the FIFA president, alleging he had told him about the plan to distribute cash a month earlier and had met no objection. Under questioning, Warner admitted that Bin Hammam had covered the costs of the Caribbean meeting. Bank statements later showed that on April 28th, Bin Hammam had wired $363,557.98 to Warner's account at Republic Bank in Trinidad, while Bin Hammam himself testified that his staffers had handed CFU staff an additional $50,000 in cash to cover expenses. But Warner claimed no money had ever changed hands, submitting statements from 13 Caribbean soccer officials flatly denying the payments to delegates were made. I remain firm and intransigent in my view, the CFU president told the committee during a long and combative session. I received nothing from Mr. Bin Hammam to give delegates. I know nothing of any money. I never spoke about any cash gifts to collect, and I am therefore saying today that I don't even know why I'm here. For his part, Blatter admitted that Warner, in a meeting on April 10th in Guatemala, had brought up his idea to hold a special CFU meeting, but that he, Blatter, had told him it was a bad idea. I was asked for advice or an opinion, and I informed Jack Warner that it should not happen, the FIFA president told the panel. At 6 in the evening, the Ethics Committee's chairman, flanked by Valk, took a seat at the front of the spacious auditorium deep inside FIFA's headquarters to inform the press of the day's decision. Citing the possibility that possible acts of corruption appear to have been committed, the chairman said Bin Hammam and Warner were provisionally suspended from all soccer activities. Blatter, meanwhile, was cleared of all charges. I agree the timing is the worst, but what's happened, happened, Valk told the astonished press corps, adding that the presidential elections would continue as planned. There is no reason for them not taking place. Blatter had survived once again. Without an opponent standing against him, he was elected 3 days later by FIFA's Congress for a fourth consecutive term, with 186 out of 203 votes in his favor. Before departing for Zurich, Warner had spent all day on the floor of the Red House, Trinidad's century-old Beaux-Arts Parliament building. Once Parliament adjourned, he stepped outside and spoke to local reporters gathered there. He was characteristically ready for a fight, and he spoke for an extended time in his florid pugilistic language, laying into Blazer and John Collins, who he felt had betrayed him. I am in FIFA for 29 consecutive years. I was the first black man to have ever been in FIFA at this level. I have come from the smallest country ever to be on the FIFA executive committee, he said. I am wielding more power in FIFA now than sometimes even the president. I must be the envy of others. I have lived 70 and almost 10, and my jack hasn't been hanged as yet. Why should it be now? By whom? The American Chuck Blazer? His American lawyer John Collins? Give me a break. Warner in a froth continued. I'll tell you something. In the next couple days, you will see a football tsunami that will hit FIFA and the world. Chapter 8. A Made Man. Jared Randall pinned the restaurant receipt to the wall of his cubicle as soon as he got back to the FBI field office. It wasn't every day that a young agent got to eat lunch with someone like Chuck Blazer, and he wanted a memento. The meeting had fallen into his lap after Blazer had spontaneously reached out to the bureau to complain about allegations of match-fixing during CONCACAF's Gold Cup, which kicked off June 5, 2011 in Dallas. Blazer had been tipped off to the issue a few weeks earlier by Chris Eaton, FIFA's head of security, and he had been deeply troubled by the rumor. He'd reached out to a friend who worked at the bureau, and his complaint eventually wound its way to Randall, who eagerly set up a meeting. The Gold Cup was Blazer's baby, and his golden goose. He'd first proposed the tournament only weeks after signing his first contract as CONCACAF's general secretary on July 31, 1990. The 8-page contract, which only he and Warner had copies of, entitled Blazer to a number of fees in lieu of an actual salary, including 10% of all sponsorship and TV rights fees from all sources received by CONCACAF. It was a salesman's idea of an employment agreement, one based on commissions, which made sense, since Blazer was at heart a salesman. Television and sponsorships were the biggest ticket items in soccer, and for every $100 worth of CONCACAF rights Blazer managed to sell, he'd take home $10. Since its first edition, held in Los Angeles in the summer of 1991, the Gold Cup had grown to become CONCACAF's cash cow, driven primarily by massive commercial interest in the U.S. and Mexican national teams. By 2009, the Gold Cup had driven CONCACAF's revenue to a record $35 million. Blazer's commissions on marketing and television sales that year reached $2.3 million, his largest take ever. The idea, then, that some bookies, common criminals for God's sake, could undermine all that by paying off a few lousy referees was incredibly unnerving. Blazer had suggested meeting in a Midtown restaurant, and Randall was more than happy to accommodate him. It was, after all, a chance to meet a member of FIFA's executive committee in the flesh, on what seemed like a perfect pretext, allowing the young agent to size the man up without letting him know what he was working on. Blazer was what Randall's boss, Mike Gaeta, liked to call a made man, fully initiated into the FIFA family. But he wasn't some piddling soldier, following orders and keeping his head down. No, Blazer was clearly a caporegime, one of the top men in the organization. He'd been in the soccer game for years, decades even, and surely knew where a lot of bodies were buried. Not only that, but unlike every other FIFA capo, Blazer was American. He wasn't living in some far-off corner of the world, far from reach. He was right up the street, just a subway ride away from the FBI offices in Lower Manhattan. And he spoke English. Until he had been assigned to the case, international soccer for Randall was all about the superstars on the field. Eye-popping scoring machines like Leo Messi, impenetrable goalies like Gianluigi Buffon, rugged, relentless fullbacks, Randall's own position, like Philip Lahm, brilliant managers like Alex Ferguson, and powerhouse clubs like Real Madrid. Randall had thought he knew a lot about the sport, but a simple internet search of soccer corruption brought up a mind-boggling universe of strange and unfamiliar names, places, and events stretching back for decades and spanning the planet. There were entire blogs dedicated to the topic, not to mention innumerable books and documentaries. And that was just in English. Searches of particular names often brought up articles in French, German, Spanish, and who knows what other languages. There were stories of vote rigging, ticket scalping, match fixing, and player transfer scams, each with its own array of obscure soccer officials at the center of the schemes. It was overwhelming. The FBI had no history investigating international soccer corruption. There were no old cases to build off, or grizzled agents who had worked the soccer beat for years to teach Randall the ropes. He had started by trying to put together a link chart, a kind of diagram of the hierarchy of the criminal organization that was often used in big complex cases with lots of potential targets, with neat little lines drawn between each person. The charts were helpful in mob cases. The Godfather was placed at the top, the lieutenants below him, and the lowly soldiers down at the bottom. The idea was to create a who's who of the soccer world, laying out how one person involved in FIFA was linked to another, and that one to a third, and so on. Randall put Blatter at the top. That much was easy. Filling in the rest was tougher. There were so many names, and their various roles seemed unclear. Was a FIFA vice president more or less powerful than its general secretary? What about confederation presidents? One thing that was clear, though, was that Chuck Blazer deserved a place near the top. If Randall could get him talking, he could explain how the whole thing worked. That was how big cases were done. You flip one guy, and he helps you gather evidence to flip another, and that one helps you get two more, and it's off to the grand jury. An investigation might have a half dozen or more cooperators at any one time, as it built toward an indictment. The goal was to get as high up the pyramid as possible. And when it comes to big, complex organizations like FIFA, insiders were the best way to get to the top in a hurry. Blazer had been interesting to both Randall and Gaeta for some time. But in the weeks since the suspicious events of Port of Spain had become public, he'd become something of a celebrity. Photos of Blazer's big furry face were constantly on CNN, and he was quoted in newspapers around the world. One story, a glowing profile by the Associated Press, that got picked up in dailies around the country, painted him as an idealistic whistleblower out to clean up the sport, a witty, gregarious man who is a tireless advocate for soccer. Randall suspected otherwise, but unlike the wise guys the FBI agents were accustomed to chasing, Blazer was no hardened criminal. His record was spotless. He didn't have any priors, not so much as a speeding ticket. Over lunch, Randall had quietly listened as the bearded New Yorker talked at length about the Gold Cup and the menace of rigged games. He was a surprisingly compelling, engaging person to listen to. And Randall, who was by nature quiet to the point of being taciturn, liked to listen. Match-fixing, it turned out, was a fascinating topic. International syndicates of gamblers conspired to pay off athletes and referees to change the outcome of games so that bets made in advance could be counted on to come in favorably. Since it was next to impossible to bribe someone to score a goal or make a brilliant save, match fixers generally arranged for teams to lose, or at least underperform. For superstars like Messi or Ronaldo, stratospheric salaries and an unblinking press made them unlikely targets for such impropriety.
Underpaid players on second-rate teams,
as well as low-rent referees, were the way to go, especially since a bettor could make as much money on the outcome of an obscure match as a World Cup final. And all that was required was enough interest for bookies to take action. And teams didn't even have to lose for a match to be fixed. Sometimes gamblers would simply bet on the score at halftime, for example, or on which team would give up a goal first. In a big confederation like CONCACAF, there were plenty of weaker teams with rosters full of players who might be willing to make some cash on the side. Nobody expected a team like Nicaragua, which had never qualified for the World Cup, to win too many matches. Those national teams were often run by easily corrupted administrators as well, giving rise to concerns that nobody was even watching to ensure clean play. Particularly interesting were the connections between the match rigging and organized crime. Guys in Randall's own squad were still neck-deep in the illegal gambling investigation involving the Russian gangster Taiwanchik. Randall had personally spent many long hours helping out that case in the field office's wire room, listening on a series of telephone wiretaps for evidence of criminal activity. In what seemed like a strange coincidence, several suspects in that case happened to live in Trump Tower, just like Blazer. It was true that match-fixing didn't seem to have much to do with the World Cup vote-buying and high-level administrative skullduggery that had gotten Gaeta interested in opening a soccer case, but it certainly seemed to have some potential for crossover, especially since it involved shadowy Russians. It looked to Randall like yet another example of the way that global soccer was profoundly dirty. The topic was, in fact, interesting enough to prompt Randall to reach out to FIFA's head of security, Chris Eaton, directly, and request the first of a series of meetings on the topic. But that angle went nowhere. And in any case, it didn't get the special agent any closer to reeling in the investigation's first cooperating witness. It was frustrating. People didn't generally cooperate willingly with an investigation. They had to be encouraged, sometimes strongly encouraged. And the best way to do that was by digging up some incriminating piece of information against the person and giving him a choice. Either help or go straight to jail. But Randall didn't have a thing on Blazer. The lunch had been memorable, but ultimately unproductive. After nearly a year, the soccer case had barely moved. If only Randall could find some kind of hook. Soon after temporarily suspending Werner and Bin Hammam, FIFA opened a full investigation into the events of Port of Spain. It hired an outside firm headed by former FBI Director Louis Free to conduct the probe. And as its investigators dug into the case, it became increasingly apparent that they were turning up substantial evidence to support the bribery allegations. Although some Caribbean delegates remained loyal to Werner and refused to cooperate with the probe, others, perhaps fearing rebuke from FIFA, began to talk. In a series of interviews in Zurich and the Bahamas, officials from seven different Caribbean nations admitted that they had entered the boardroom at the Hyatt and been offered an envelope full of cash, and provided photographs and other evidence of the payments. Werner, back in Port of Spain, had been quietly negotiating another huge payment from Bin Hammam. Werner had contacted him not long after his initial suspension, and the two, using intermediaries, agreed upon a roughly $1.2 million payment to be wired to three different accounts in Trinidad, one held by his personal assistant, one by his son Daryl, and a third account controlled by his other son, Darion. Although Bin Hammam wired the money, in installments of $412,000, $368,000, and $432,000. The payments were held up by compliance officers at the Trinidadian banks.